You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Nikita.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm doing well. How about you?
I am not complaining. I'm a little groggy for reasons I won't go into. But let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. You're Nikita Petrov, member of the Non-Zero team and also publisher of the Psychopolitica newsletter. And you're in Spain and from Russia. And did I say this is a Non-Zero podcast? I guess I did. Anyway, it certainly is. What should we talk about?
Well, the two most recent things are you published a new issue of the Non-Zero newsletter that explains the Trump doctrine, and you went to some mysterious conference that I want to hear about. Let's start with Trump.
Okay.
I caught a clip. There's an epigraph that you use in the piece, and I have the video of this quote by Trump. Let me play this.
And Mr. President, if you are declaring war against these cartels and Congress is likely to approve of that process, why not just ask for a declaration of war?
Well, I don't think we're going to necessarily ask for a declaration of war. I think we're just going to kill people that are bringing drugs into our country. Okay? We're going to kill them. You know, they're going to be like dead. Okay.
I mean, the first thing you note about that is I hope people in Blue America appreciate how well that goes over for a lot of people, right? It's like almost everyone anywhere, including me, has some connection to someone who died of an opioid overdose. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe that's an exaggeration, but they're all aware of the problem. It's kind of like a local problem in much of red America and parts of blue America, and people aren't happy about it. And when Trump says, okay, we're going to kill these guys, and you know, the way he says it, they're going to be like dead, you know, that's like a good delivery. And now, of course, also, you know, what people like me are noticing and some other people in blue America is that he's saying, screw the rule of law. It's true that I'm calling this a war against drug cartels. And I guess that's the closest thing to an argument that it's legal to go around bombing boats. But I'm not going to bother to get an actual declaration of war. You know, that, of course, the questions of national law and international law bother me, but they don't even bother many people in blue America. I mean, let's face it, this is like a...
But also, when was the last time America had a declaration of war?
Right. It's been... Presidents have been disregarding that requirement for pretty much all my lifetime. I mean, some uses of force have been authorized, but by and large, you're right. I mean, presidents just don't wait. And we don't, you know, blue America doesn't complain about it when the president is blue. What we're kind of backing into is what the subject of this piece in the Non-Zero newsletter is, which is about, first of all, in an immediate sense, it's about the gathering of force near Venezuela for what looks like some sort of regime change operation, nominally justified as part of the war on drugs. But as we pointed out in the newsletter weeks ago, kind of cribbing from this guy who hosts the antiwar.com podcast, who I first heard this point made by, you know, if it's war on fentanyl, Venezuela is not your problem. That's not where the fentanyl comes from. Cocaine comes from Venezuela, but there's not a lot of bemoaning the cocaine crisis in America. It does damage, but a lot of drugs do damage. It's not the crisis of the moment. You would be bombing boats in the Pacific or maybe, bombing Mexico or something if you were going to disregard law and bomb things in the name of stopping fentanyl. You know, it's a regime change operation. Marco Rubio, who is not just Secretary of State, but National Security Advisor. That's very rare that you have a foreign policy advisor with this much control, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there have been dominant figures, Henry Kissinger, kind of Zbigniew Brzezinski, you know, cases where one or the other of those two positions was dominant in the administration. Rubio's got them both. It doesn't matter which position is dominant. There's only one guy. And he's a total neocon, which Trump had said he was opposed to. He has said he's against neocon regime change wars, right? And Rubio, of course, kind of has been acting for some time while, I guess, angling for this job, maybe even before that, while adapting to the MAGA era. You know, he's been toning down his neoconishness and acting like he sees the wisdom of military restraint. But, you know, his he's long had a particular focus on regime change in places like Cuba and Venezuela. You know, he's from Florida, his family's from Cuba. And they can claim it's about drugs, but, you know, it seems to be much more about the fact that it's an authoritarian autocracy. And that's what neocons want to declare war on, purportedly. And that's what we're doing. So anyway, that's the immediate thing. Now, it may not be a war. I think what Trump would like to happen is that when you have this much force gathered, the Venezuelan military just stages a coup because they don't want to get bombed to death, you know? Now, the truth is, I'd be pretty surprised if Trump was really willing to put troops ashore, because some will probably get killed. So I think the most Venezuela has to worry about enduring is an intensive bombing campaign. And I don't know how much of that could Trump do before even some, I don't know. But anyway, that's the prospect. He would like to induce a coup regime change. Mm-hmm. If he fails, there will probably be bombing. It's going to look kind of embarrassing. I mean, he's got like a shitload. Ships. Latest thing is a whole aircraft carrier group, not just the carrier, but all the allied, you know, the associated warships. He's got what, B1s nearby now. They move them. And so we'll see. Anyway, that's part of this piece. But the part that I think interested you, and you said some interesting things about when you emailed me about it, is the Trump Doctrine part. The title of the piece is The Trump Doctrine. I was picking up on a piece that Daniel Larrison wrote in his newsletter, Eunomia, about this, saying that in the course of this Venezuelan thing, Trump has kind of articulated what actually should be considered the Trump Doctrine. And Daniel's being slightly fanciful, maybe. I mean, I don't think he'd say, you know, if you sat down and articulated the Trump Doctrine, it would be exactly this. But he's, I'll read the quote from him. First he says, well, here's the heart of it. Contrary to a lot of bad analysis over the years, the president is not reluctant to use force. He jumps at the chance to use it, especially when there is no chance that the target can fight back. There are many non-lethal and non-military alternatives available, but he has decided that, quote, we're going to kill them. He was inspired by the quote you played at the beginning. Right. And then Daniel writes, that is the real Trump Doctrine. And I basically say, you know, it is. I mean, I would put it a little differently, but this is a pretty good candidate. I mean, let's be clear about what a doctrine is. So there's this tradition. I mean, the first presidential foreign policy doctrines were like, okay, Truman Doctrine. And these are were things that were articulated in a high-profile speech. The Carter Doctrine, which said basically, don't mess with the Persian Gulf or we'll go to war with anybody who tries. That was articulated in a speech. But then the Reagan Doctrine, there was no single speech or anything, but Charles Krauthammer, who's no longer alive, said, this is what the Reagan Doctrine is. He's not just going to contain communism, he's going to roll it back through proxy wars, which Charles approved of. And So there's, since then, since the Reagan Doctrine, it's kind of every president, like if some various commentators, you know, try to articulate what their doctrine is. And it isn't their a crystallization of the overall foreign policy. It's kind of a new principle or theme that they add that is distinctive, that they add to the foreign policy paradigm they inherit. Mm-hmm.
Well, it doesn't it all go back to the Monroe Doctrine? This is what comes to mind when I hear
that. Yeah, I think maybe the Truman Doctrine was the first thing to kind of resuscitate that tradition. But yeah, and it's funny you should mention it, because in a way, that is inspiring what Trump is doing. You know, I ask a friend right. who's very well versed in these things, like, well, shouldn't Steve Bannon oppose this gratuitous military intervention? I thought he was opposed to regime change wars. And he said, well, Bannon's kind of a Monroe Doctrine guy. So, yeah, mm-hmm. don't get into wars in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. But, you know, sure, knock a few heads in the Western Hemisphere. And although the Monroe Doctrine was supposedly about external interference, you know, European interference or somebody's right. interference, we're not even claiming that anybody, are we, that is interfering in Venezuela. So that's not classic Monroe Doctrine, but still,
sure,
the idea
but it's like
is
2.0.
Right. The idea is the Western Hemisphere is our playground. We can do what we want.
That's what it looks like to me. I don't claim any expertise on depth of analysis here, but like just looking, you know, the thread that I obviously keep getting updated on is the Ukraine war. And it's at some points it gets tiresome because like they decided to meet, they decided not to meet, they say there's progress, there's no progress. Mm-hmm. And between like, getting these updates and then occasionally turning on a Trump live thing from the White House where signing new decrees and there's 10 other things that he's doing this day. It eventually kind of added up to me for me to a vision where he's got a lot of things to do. What he would like to see in the world outside of the Western Hemisphere is everybody to stop whatever wars they're engaged in so that he can do business with everybody. And it's going to be tough business. Like he's going to force some country into a bad deal. He's going to come to a deal that everybody's happy with somebody who he considers a peer. But basically with the outside world, he wants to do business. Here in the Western Hemisphere, he would like to get as much control as possible. And so merger is the new term that I've heard him apply to Canada. It's not annexation. He would like to see a merger between the US and Canada. And he would like to buy Greenland. And Mexico has these cartels that he's going to use the military against. And Venezuela is nearby. So he's just like consolidating power within his, what he sees as his sphere of influence. And then the rest of the world can do whatever they want. If they are not, if Russia, Ukraine are not going to come to a peace deal, I guess that's it. I guess that's how it's playing out. But he would like them to stop fighting so that he can have a deal with Ukraine and a deal with Russia and do business.
And a Nobel Peace Prize, because he would claim credit.
A Nobel Peace Prize, yeah.
For it. Yeah, I think that's true. And I think, you know, that's related to something I said, and I think you hadn't read this when you sent me the email that contained kind of much of what you said, which I thought was very insightful. The, you know, I said, so first of all, Larrison's nominee, I think it does, you know, make sense. I mean, to elaborate and without mentioning other things Daniel says, Trump, he just thinks shows of force are good politics, and he may be right. That by and large, people just like a strong president. And mm-hmm. because he, more than any other recent president, which is saying something, because they haven't been especially respectful of international law, certainly, or even national law, more than any other president, he just disregards national law and international law. There just are no rules in Trump's world, except for might makes right. And so he is free to use force whenever he wants. He thinks it's good policy. And I think that's so Daniel's kind of right there. I said, and this is related to what you said, the other nominee I can think of for Trump doctrine is something I actually approve of, is his willingness to do business with countries regardless of their ideological character. Refreshing change after Biden's war on autocracy and all the other various counterproductive American attempts to remake the world in its own ideological image. But I said you could see Venezuela as kind of representing tension between these two candidates for the Trump doctrine. You know, kind of Daniel's like, just kill him. And, you know, the kind of indifference to ideology. And it looks like Daniels is winning, because the truth is, this is an ideological move, I think. And, you know, this is Rubio's inspired by kind of ideologically motivated regime change. Trump hopes for other benefits, but none of them couldn't be gotten more readily without war. So anyway, and that one part is related to your take. And I think you're right. I mean, I think the way you put it, that would be a good candidate. It's different from what I said, and it would be a good candidate for Trump doctrine. I mean, I think it's horrible because it also involves complete disregard for all rules and laws, right? But I think it's a good candidate for Trump doctrine.
Have you seen that movie, The Biopic Apprentice, about Trump?
No.
It's a good movie.
And I regret to say that your pronunciation of biopic seems to be gaining ground in a larger world. I mean, it's a biography, and it's a, you know, picture in the sense of movie.
But how should I say it?
I ultimately lose all battles I fight about grammar and pronunciation. So, like, I yield to.
I'm not a native speaker. I do make mistakes.
No, a lot of people are saying this biopic.
Biopic,
I think.
And you're
anyway,
preferred to.
I have not. What does it say about Trump?
Well, it's I really enjoyed it. I don't know how much of it is factual and how much is imagined, but certainly even the bits that are imagined are based on some circumstantial kind of evidence. But there's a what's the name of that lawyer who's supposed to be his mentor? Roy Cohn.
Roy Cohn, C-O-H-N. He was a Joseph McCarthy guy. Total thug. Creepy guy. And yeah, Trump ran into it. And he was this kind of guy, this kind of dark but powerful guy in the Manhattan scene in the wake of the McCarthy era, and Trump encountered him then, and I guess Roy Cohn kind of tutored him on the wisdom of just breaking all the rules you can possibly break.
Well, he frames it as it is a nation of men, not laws. You go to court,
perfect.
You sue everybody, you fight. You then figure out where the limits of your power are, like what you can do and what you can't do, but you do it by testing it, by trying to win everything. Deny everything, sue everybody, fight, because it is not like, to me, that phrase, after I watched the movie and then I'm watching Trump operate, I can see that as like sort of without judgment. You can see a situation and look at it as if it's a nation of laws, like, we have these rules and we are supposed to, that's what brings it together. That's why the system persists. Or you can say the laws are secondary. It's a nation of men. They fight, they compete. And that's the way the society works. It's through competition that you come to an equilibrium. Mm-hmm. And it seems that Trump sees the world this way. I should at some point find this clip and prepare for one of our conversations too, because I really like it when he says, basically, there's a game. And a lot of people are playing it at a very high level, and I'm one of these people. and he's describing the world. Is like that's the entirety of what's going on. There's a game being played. He always uses his metaphors. Do you have cards? Do you not have cards? It's not about the rules. It's not about the law. It's about whether you can get on top or not.
Right.
And it can be an ethos that is, you know, embraced. You know, it doesn't have. You can just take that as a view of the world and run with it, and it's not necessary. Like, it's not obvious that it's evil to see the world this way.
Yeah, and I don't want to pretend that, you know, this hasn't always been to some extent a power game, right? I mean, right. just in the sense that affluent people are more likely to get off of for crimes they commit than poor people because they can afford better lawyers or they're better connected. That stuff happens. It has always happened. It's bad. But, and, you know, presidents have tended to be playing more hardball beneath the surface than they let on. One thing about Trump is he just lets on, you know, he brags about it. You know, I'm breaking the rules. Like, and if it's an era when Americans are discontented enough with the status quo, especially, that's a great talking point, right? The system's not working for them, so fuck the system. And, you know, but I do, you know, I think there's value in hypocrisy, you know. There's this saying, hypocrisy is the tribute that virtue pays to vice. I've never had anyone explain that to me entirely, but I think maybe what it means is, look, yeah, hypocrisy is, we all do some of it. And, you know, there are these rules we purportedly subscribe to. We break them sometimes. But there is still, to preserve what virtue you can preserve in this fallen world, you need to uphold the rules. So that means it's better for people to profess adherence to the rules while breaking them than to break them and brag about breaking the rules, especially if they're president. Because that minimized the extent of departure from the rules ultimately. Now, that's my take on what that means. In any event, it's my belief that, I didn't even want to be that cynical about it. I do think there have been a number of presidents, although they've all played hardball in some sense, who understood that it really is important to continue to respect the rule of law. You know, Eisenhower gave a great speech when he sent troops to Little Rock to enforce Brown versus Board. He didn't support Brown versus Board. You know, he didn't think the schools should be forcibly integrated. But he just laid it out. Like, here's the way the system works. The president obeys the laws. The ultimate interpreter of the laws is the Supreme Court, blah, blah, blah. And now, that is so antithetical to Trump's way of being. By the way, I may be misrepresenting that, but that's the spirit of Eisenhower's speech. Or his comments, whenever he made them. But, I was just
play that video.
Yeah, yeah.
Tucker played that video of Eisenhower while defending Trump's deployment of National Guard.
But that's such bullshit. I'm sorry. Because Trump's Eisenhower would have never, I mean, he called in troops to redress a situation where state authorities were saying, we are going to defy this Supreme Court ruling. We're doing it now. We're not going to let this black guy into the university. That was Kennedy over the violation of the Civil Rights Act. We're not going to let this black girl into the public school or whatever. Right. As state and or local officials were saying, we are going to defy the Supreme Court. Absolutely clear cut. Trump is saying, when there's trouble in a blue city, it's a national emergency. Well, that's, you know, he has so obviously abused the whole idea of a national emergency. He's just making shit up. for Tucker Carlson to compare what Trump is doing to what Eisenhower did is an absolute travesty and kind of a slur against Eisenhower. And I had my issues with Eisenhower. He authorized a lot of covert operations in the world. No, he didn't authorize them. That was the beauty of it. We don't know. There's no paper trail. But anyway, I saw the Tucker thing. You know, I was just at a conference where there was a guy who had worked in the Trump administration until a few weeks ago, and he said, and he's not particularly against Trump. I don't know why he left, actually. I think it may have been a term limited job he had. But, he said, whenever there is tension between pursuing in the administration, throughout the administration, whenever there's tension between pursuing short-term gain and upholding some institution or institutional principle, they just go with the short-term gain. There's just no thought given to the importance of institutions or principles like the whole rule of law, you know? And he didn't say that last part, but I think that's the idea.
That's another part of my imagining of a Trump doctrine is policy adjusts to his personality, his temperament, which is like ADD, basically, you know, short term, like I'm really engaged for a minute on this one, and then I'm switching to another one. And I wonder if that's actually a wise strategy. Like that's what I kind of see in these Ukraine negotiations where Russians and Ukrainians are trying to, like, they are playing a game, they're trying to have their strategy, and he, it seems from the outside, is just tired of both of them. He's like, I want this to be done. It's not getting done. I'm switching to, I've got university to deal with. I've got Venezuela going on. I've got, like, he has, on any given day, you can click on, like, on YouTube, it appears, it gets recommended to me now, live from the White House, Trump's making an announcement. Like, in a week, he does 30 different things. He's reinstituting Columbus Day. He's doing this. He's doing that. And I wonder if that is a viable approach. You just do as many things as possible. You don't really plan on which of them is going to work out and which of them is going to fail. You just move on from the things that failed. You claim much more of a success in those that did transpire sort of according to your intention. And then just move on. And then it's the new week and new month. And in 4 years, you can do a lot. And then after the fact, there's a shape of what you've been able to accomplish.
Yeah. And every new headline he makes when he moves on distracts attention from any failure there may have been the day before, right? He'll demand this, demand that, or say, I'm going to slap 100% tariff on China or whatever. And you're like, no, you're not. And yet, America's journalists put in the headlines, Trump says, you know, what is obviously bullshit. And and then, you know, 3 days later or whatever, he says, yeah, I don't think that's sustainable, 100% tariff. Yeah, no kidding. But anyway, he just keeps moving on. So you just can't even pause and keep track of how bad his record is, you know, and how much bullshit he said, because you're right. And then the moving on can be a negotiating asset. It's like, hey, if you want your war to end, you better focus, because I've only got like tomorrow I'm going to get distracted by something.
Right,
I don't know what it is, but it'll be something. So I don't know. It's very bad. As comical and amusing as it can be, if seen in a particular light. It's bad because, I was talking to a guy at this conference who, is actually about to go into the Defense Department, knows Pete Hegseth. And he said, but you know, Trump, like, you know, he's old, what, a couple more years of him. And I said, no, you don't understand. He is, with all this norm breaking, is paving the way for his successor, who terrifyingly will be more competent than he is. You know, you're already seeing like J.D. Vance, Stephen Miller. Actually, interesting question. Does Stephen Miller have presidential aspirations? That's possibly scarier than the fact that J.D. Vance has them, that raw demagoguery and flagrant disregard for the rule of law, especially on Miller's part, is scary. I mean, they're already talking the Trump. So the people vying to succeed him are already like talking the Trump. You know, they are, you know, they're embracing the norm violation. He's paved the way. It's a precedent. That is an enduring thing that he's doing. And, you know, and I said, no, you're wrong. I mean, this is the way, you know, the path. Look, first of all, he may well try to stay in power in 3 years, but the path to a more competent person who has no regard for the rule of law or even ultimately democracy is being paved big time.
But how do you see his effects on the world, not U.S. domestically, but in the world? Like the Gaza war, he seems to be trying, like he got the ceasefire and I still don't understand at all the America-Israel relationships, but one thing that...
I can help!
But one thing that struck me is when he's asked about the West Bank, he suddenly sounds firm. He's like, Israel's not going to occupy West Bank. Don't worry about the West Bank.
Well, first of
Ukraine,
all, pathetic.
He seems to genuinely want the Ukraine war to stop. Doesn't seem like he's making a whole lot of progress on that front, but it seems like he would like it to stop. Do you see him as, could he be, when all said is done, a positive force in the world broadly? The U.S. becoming less of a hegemon in the world and the overall system getting closer to some kind of a equilibrium?
Well, I think there's no way that, in my view, given my values and my conception of what the kind of world we need to build, there's no way he'll be a net positive. You know, again, he is completely eroding the idea of respecting any laws or any norms. You know, it's like, and that's just super dangerous. And you know, as for Israel, I mean, it depends on what day you catch him on, you know?
Right.
I mean, look, he's been no worse than Biden. And, this gets back to the U.S.-Israel relationship. I mean, they're all bad on Israel. All the American presidents are, you know, just extremely indulgent of whatever Bibi Netanyahu wants to do. And so, that's true, he may be no worse in that regard, but I don't know. Do I trust him when he says, don't worry about the West Bank? No. I mean, first of all, what he's saying is, I have enough leverage to keep Israel from annexing the West Bank, which is true. He has the leverage. Will he want to use it in a week? Who knows? He's Trump. But B, the ongoing, the situation in the West Bank is deteriorating independent of annexation per se. Mm-hmm. Settlers, violence is displacing Palestinians. The Israeli army can be seen on video sometimes aiding and abetting it, like keeping watch while settlers set fire to a Palestinian car in the village in which the Palestinians live, okay? And so far as I know, all that's still going on. And it was going on under Biden, going on under Trump, and all of that sets the stage for eventual annexation. It is ethnic cleansing. It's going on right now. They're pushing Palestinians out of their home, even aside from that, there's just an increasing number of settlements like being declared in Israel on Trump's watch. There's been a massive amount of that in the short time he's been in power. like new settlements authorized and stuff. So, no, I don't. I'm not ultimately optimistic. I mean, as of now, it looks like this thing he did with the ceasefire has at least put on pause Israel's aspiration to entirely ethnic cleanse Gaza. They would like the Gazans, at least, you know, the BB government would like the Gazans to just leave Gaza. And Trump has put that on pause. Meanwhile, the Israel army has more than half of Gaza. Okay, they're occupying that much. So I don't know if we call that progress.
Right.
But maybe, you know, compared to the baseline, you know, Biden and so on, maybe it is.
I want to ask you about this conference, but let's finish this with a little clip of Trump where I thought he came off as endearing.
You had talked a couple weeks ago, you were doing an interview and you talked about how you hope to end the war in Ukraine because it might help you get into heaven. How does this help? Does this help?
I mean, you know, I'm being a little cute. I don't think there's anything going to get me in heaven. Okay, I really don't. I think I'm not maybe heaven bound. I may be in heaven right now as we fly an Air Force One. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to make heaven, but I've made life a lot better for a lot of people.
This is the kind of thing that endears me sometimes to him.
He's a great entertainer, man. Just only yesterday, I said to my family, which is consists of two left-wing daughters who live in Brooklyn and a wife who is, more or less the kind of mother you'd expect to have two left-wing children live in Brooklyn. I said, look, admit it. When he called Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas, that was funny. And even more so when it turned out she didn't have a drop of Native American blood, as mm-hmm. she had claimed in getting into Harvard or whatever she did. But they said, I mean, one of my daughters, I said, I increasingly treat him as a comedian. He is funny. Mm-hmm. And that's just the way she's coping. It's like she's still left wing. And they've been actively left wing, you know, demonstrations and so on. But, he is genuinely funny. Sometimes you're laughing at him, not with him, but in that clip, you're definitely laughing with him. And it's such a, people find it such a refreshing departure from what all presidents like before him would have said, you know?
Yeah. And that's how he won the first time around. I remember seeing those Republican debates when it was still the primaries. And it's like eight people who are just can't relate. They're just boring. They're robotic. They sound like politician. Like mm-hmm. one is not different from the other. And this guy shows up and they don't know how to handle him, how to deal mm-hmm. with curveballs.
Yeah, I genuinely wondered at that point, like, is this playing when it's just like junior high level shit when he says little Marco and, you know, Sleepy Jeb Bush. I mean, that's not even funny junior high humor. Let's face it. I wouldn't have laughed at that in junior high. There's jokes I would have laughed at then that I wouldn't laugh at now. Those are not them. And I thought, like, shit. I mean, A, do people think that is funny? And B, don't they think that a president at a minimum should be better than the average, you know, than many Americans in this modest regard, like just totally cheap, juvenile insults. I was wrong. No, the answer came. No, there half of America is totally happy with that.
Well, there's the way I remember it when I saw these primary debates, most people were not considering him a serious candidate. And so right. They were enjoying not so much that like his rising in the polls, it's his breaking the monotony and the bullshit of the establishment. Yeah. And they couldn't handle it. Like they didn't know what to do with him. And it's not that he was especially funny. It was enjoyable to see these other people not knowing what to do. And I saw that as a sign of incompetency. Like the establishment has been insulated from people like Trump. Like I would think it, by the time you get to the primary debates, you should have enough experience debating all kinds of people that you know what to do with somebody who's throwing juvenile these you know phrases and nicknames and whatnot. You should be able to handle a person like this. Like a stand-up comedian early on in his career learns how to deal with a heckler who's just throwing things out there. And these other candidates in the primary debates didn't know what to do with it.
Not at all. Not at all. I remember Rand Paul, I think, said, "What is this? A junior high playground?" Something to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, yeah, apparently, and that works. I mean, by the way, Rand Paul is a Republican of principle who is opposing the whole Venezuelan operation. God bless him. You know, he's a serious conservative. He takes the Constitution seriously. He takes laws seriously. At least at the national level, he's probably not a big evangelist for international law. But I don't know. A surprising number of conservative restrainers turned out to be actually. I mean, turned out to be pay some attention to international law. But so what should we? Before long, we should go to overtime. What's that?
Oh yeah. Well.
Where are we?
Do you want to tease a little bit about this conference?
Yeah, no,
I went to a conference.
It was off the record, but what's interesting, so I can't, you know, report on things people said, which is too bad because there was some really illuminating, you know, there were, I was in one session where there was somebody who'd been very much involved in the Biden administration's China tech policy. And
So can you explain what is the framing of this thing? Who were what kinds of people?
This is
attended?
A funny kind of conference. I it's not a funny kind. It is kind of because on the one hand, there's a kind of conference where you pay a lot of money to attend like the all-in summit, and you're in the presence of greatness because the all-in podcast hosts, and they have these great guests. Plus, it's like whatever they charge, what are they charge? I don't know, 10,000, 20,000, whatever they charge is enough that you'll kind of, you know, it's a Silicon Valley crowd, I gather, and they charge enough that, and this is also true of the TED conference, by the way, is, yeah, you go to see the talks and maybe mingle with the people who give the talks, but also you go to network with the other people who can afford to pay this much. To listen to some talks, and it becomes, you know, that becomes part of the velvet rope. In addition to the fact that people have to be invited. Now, in some cases, that's a pretense. But in any event, there's that kind of conference, and there's the other kind of conference where, you know, it doesn't cost anything at the other end of the spectrum. Various things fall under that rubric. This conference is. It is invitation only. You pay a small amount. It really is about enough to cover meals because it's at a nice hotel and the meals are good and they're not making money off of this. It's about enough for meals. Plus, you have to pay for the hotel. You have to pay for your airfare. It is invitation only. And it's an interesting group of people. And it's designed... They say it's kind of designed for introverts, and I think most of the people there aren't introverts. I kind of am, but it is well designed for introverts, and I can explain all that. But
so is it tech people? Is it political? Is it
less? Its origins are tech, but this year there were kind of more people from. Social sciences, humanities, and relatively fewer libertarians, which had always, I'd always found a little off-putting about it before. Heavy kind of Silicon Valley kind of libertarianism and Last year's was in Austin. So you had some real, right before the election, and you got a lot of, you know, not just tech libertarians, but you had an increasing number of pro-MAGA people, not that many, but at the conference itself, I mean, but so there was that vibe. It changes a little year to year. But I mean, in overtime, we can talk. Well, what else are we going to talk about? I do want to talk a little about how they make this introvert friendly. What seems to me distinctive about the conference? But
okay, so here's what I suggest for the overtime. You'll tell what you can about this conference. I can share my experiences. I'm just very curious about this type of thing. Like, there's apparently a world of these networking events of different kinds, from tech to like the two things that I can bring up is I went, it's not exactly networking, it's a course at the University of Amsterdam about psychedelics last summer I went, but there's networking going on there. You know, I've been isolated from the rest of the world. I've been living in Russia. So now I'm discovering that there are these places you can go and there are these currents of activity. So there are people who are learning to be psychedelic scientists and consultants and this and that. And there's, you know, a vision of a future that they can work together on advancing. Another thing I went to is a retreat in Greece. Was about dreams, and we visited these ancient oracular sites. I can tell you a little bit.
Oh, Nikita, I had a dream about you last night.
Is it overtime material?
No, it's not, but I'm only going to talk about it in overtime. Not that there's anything to hide in particular. And I want to emphasize, I had emailed you right before I went to bed, and I knew we were going to tape this when we woke up. So I don't dream about Nikita every night, folks, okay? Let's just be clear. But I've had a couple of really interesting dreams I want to talk about, because I think that maybe I don't know. My experience with dreams fits into a particular conception of what the function of dreams is, and I want to talk about that.
Let's talk about dreams. I had a non-zero dream before I fully got back on board with the non-zero staff. I talked to, you know, the staff members, and I had a dream where Tom gave me like a story from his journalist past that I thought was fascinating. And I keep thinking about it as a kind of guiding light in terms of what kind of messaging we want to develop at NetZero.
Well, let's talk about that too. I'm writing it down. Meanwhile, you can finish what you were going to say about your dream conference. Before you do, I'm going to say, like, our discussion of community building and networking and stuff will be in overtime, which is for paid subscribers, the Non-Zero newsletter, easy to become one. Go to Non-Zero, look for the posts associated with this. That's one way, this podcast. But those conversations will be in the context of our increasing emphasis on community members among non-zero readers, not just paid subscribers, although some things, of course, involve only paid subscribers. But,
right.
But
so this is the practical dimension why I think it's interesting to talk about these conferences and whatnot, because we're trying to build a community. We now have this Discord server. The link should be in the video description if you're watching this on YouTube, and in show notes. If you're listening to a podcast, I started doing, this is something else I wanted to bring up. I started doing these calls with subscribers. People can just schedule an hour of talking to me, and I really enjoyed some of them. And there are some questions from those conversations I can bring up. And just, in general, let's talk about this community building dimension of the NetZero Foundation, Media Empire.
And more about dreams than your dream. Your dream conference or whatever, not conference, your dream. What was it?
Retreat, it was called, yeah.
Dream retreat. Okay. All right. So thanks to everybody who's followed us this far. If you're not going to become a paid subscriber and just feel guilty about that for some reason, which seems unlikely, I gather, but you might think, well, if I can't give them money, what can I give them? And what are some of the answers, Nikita? Like, I'll give you a clue. Smashing the like button is one.
Joined the Discord server and became an active member of the community suggesting things.
Yeah, we have a Discord server. You can be just a regular subscriber. I should have plugged that in the newsletter I sent out. But this was a late.
It's a lively place, by the way. It's, you know, we didn't know how much activity we're going to get early on. It's conversations are happening. There's like a dozen of different channels there now. And a lot of them are alive.
The Non-Zero Discord is rocking. So, yeah. So, okay. So, thanks, everybody. Rate and review, Nikita, was the correct answer after I said smash the like
button. I'll learn.
We'll have a little tutorial for Nikita. Not in overtime, but in post-overtime. Okay. So, thanks, everybody. We're heading into overtime.